hospital, where her mangled toe was amputated without anesthetics and treated with salt water. In addition to harder physical work, secondary school students spent more time finding fault with themselves and one another. They wrote in their corn husk notebooks, preparing for the self-censure sessions that took place after the evening meal. About 10 students a night had to admit to something. Shin tried to meet with his classmates before these sessions to sort out who would confess to what. They invented sins that would satisfy teachers without provoking draconian punishment. Shin remembers confessing to eating corn he found on the ground and to taking a catnap when no one was looking. If students volunteered enough transgressions, punishments were usually a smack on the head and a warning to work harder. Wedged closely together, 25 boys slept on the concrete floor in the secondary school dormitory. The strongest boys slept near, but not too near, a coal-heated flue that ran under the floor. Weaker boys, including Shin, slept farther away and often shivered through the night. Some had no choice but to try to sleep on top of the flue, where they risked severe burns when the heating system flared up. Shin remembers a stoutly built, prideful 12-year-old named Ryu Hak Chol. He slept wherever he chose, and he was also the only boy who dared sass a teacher. Ryu ditched his work assignment one day, and his disappearance was quickly reported. His teacher sent Shin's class to find the missing boy. "Why'd you stop working and run away?" the teacher asked when Ryu had been found and marched back to school. To Shin's astonishment, Ryu did not apologize. "I got hungry, so I went to eat," he said flatly. The teacher, too, was astonished. "Is this son of a bitch talking back?" the teacher asked. He ordered students to tie Ryu to a tree. They took off his shirt and bound him with wire. "Beat him until he comes to his senses," the teacher said. Without a second thought, Shin joined his classmates in thrashing Ryu. Chapter 3, The Upper Crust. Shin was 9 years old when the North Korean caste system knocked him on the head. He and about 30 of his classmates were walking in early spring toward the train station where their teacher had sent them to pick up coal that had spilled from railroad cars during loading. The station is near the southwestern corner of Camp 14, and to get there from school, students had to pass below the Bowie-Wan compound, which sits on a bluff above the Taedong River. Children of guards live in the compound and attend school there. From up above, the guards' children shouted at Shin and his classmates as they walked by. "Reactionary sons of bitches are coming!" Rocks the size of fists rained down on the prison children. With the river below and the bluff above, they had no place to hide. A rock hit Shin in the face, just below his left eye, opening up a deep cut. Shin and his classmates shrieked and cowered on the dirt road, trying to protect their heads with their arms and hands. A second rock struck Shin in the head, knocking him to the ground and making him dizzy. When his head cleared, the stoning had stopped. Many of his classmates were moaning and bleeding. Moon, his neighbor and classmate who later lost her big toe in the mine, had been knocked out. The leader of Shin's class, Hong Ju-hyun, who was supposed to be a kind of foreman for the day's work mission, was also out cold. Earlier that morning at school, their teacher had told them to hurry ahead to the train station and start work. He said he would catch up later. When the teacher finally walked down the road and discovered his bloodied student sprawled in the road, he became angry. "What are you doing not getting yourselves to work?" he shouted. Students timidly asked what they should do with classmates who were still unconscious. "Put them on your backs and carry them," the teacher instructed. "All you need to do is work hard." In the years ahead, when Shin spotted Bowie-Wan children anywhere in the camp, he walked in the opposite direction if he could. Bowie-Wan children had every reason to throw stones at the likes of Shin. His blood, as that of the offspring of irredeemable sinners, was tainted in the worst conceivable way. Bowie-Wan children, however, came from families whose lineage had been sanctified by the great leader. To identify and isolate his perceived political enemies, Kim Il-sung created a neo-feudal, blood-based pecking order in 1957. The government classified and, to a considerable extent, segregated the entire North Korean population based on the perceived reliability of an individual's parents and grandparents. North Korea called itself the workers' paradise. But even as it professed allegiance to communist ideals of equality, it invented one of the world's most rigidly stratified caste systems. Three broad classes were created, with 51 subgroups. At the top, members of the core class could obtain jobs in government, the Korean Workers' Party, officer ranks of the military, and the intelligence services. The core class included farm workers, families of soldiers killed during the Korean War, families of troops who had served with Kim Il-sung fighting against Japanese occupation, and government workers. The next level was the wavering or neutral class, which included soldiers, technicians, and teachers. At the bottom was the hostile class, whose members were suspected of opposing the government. They included former property owners, relatives of Koreans who had fled to South Korea, Christians, and those who worked for the Japanese colonial government that controlled the Korean Peninsula before World War II. Their descendants now worked in mines and factories. They are not allowed into universities. Besides dictating career opportunities, the system shaped geographic destiny, with the core class allowed to live in and around Pyongyang. Many members of the hostile class were resettled to distant provinces along the Chinese border. Some members of the wavering class could move up in the system by joining the Korean People's Army, serving with distinction, and with luck and connections securing a lower rung in the ruling party. Also, rapid growth of private markets made some traders from the wavering and hostile classes wealthy, allowing them to buy and bribe their way into better living standards than some of the political elite. For government positions, though, family background decided nearly everything, including who had the right to throw stones at Shin. The only North Koreans considered trustworthy enough to become guards in political prison camps were men like Ahn Myung-chol, the son of a North Korean intelligence officer. He was recruited into the Boibu at 19, after 2 years of military service. As part of the process, the loyalty of his entire extended family was checked. He was also required to sign a document saying he would never disclose the existence of the camps. 60% of the 200 men who were recruited with him as guards were also the sons of intelligence officers. Ahn worked as a guard and driver in four labor camps, not including Camp 14, for 7 years in the late 1980s and early 1990s. He fled to China in 1994 after his father, who supervised regional food distribution, ran afoul of his superiors and committed suicide. After finding his way to South Korea, Ahn found work as a banker in Seoul and married a South Korean woman. They have two children. He also became a human rights activist. After his defection, he learned that his sister and brother were sent to a labor camp, where his brother later died. When we spoke over a Chinese dinner in Seoul in 2009, Ahn wore a dark blue suit, a white shirt, a striped tie, and half-framed glasses. He looked prosperous and spoke in a quiet, careful way. Still, he is a man of intimidating size, with large hands and linebacker shoulders. When he was training to be a guard, he studied the Korean martial art of Taekwondo, learned riot suppression techniques, and was instructed not to worry if his treatment of prisoners caused injury or death. In the camps, he became accustomed to hitting prisoners who did not meet work quotas. He remembers beating up a hunchback prisoner. It was normal to beat prisoners, he said, explaining that his instructors taught him never to smile and to think of inmates as dogs and pigs. We were taught not to think of them as human beings, he said. The instructors told us not to show pity. They said, if you do, you will become a prisoner. Although pity was forbidden, there were few other guidelines for treatment of prisoners. As a result, Ahn said, guards were free to indulge their appetites and eccentricities, often preying on attractive young women prisoners, who would usually consent to sex for better treatment. Ahn said that if this resulted in babies, women and their babies were killed. He noted that he had personally seen newborns clubbed to death with iron rods. The theory behind the camps was to cleanse onto three generations the families of incorrect thinkers, so it was inconsistent to allow another generation to be born. Guards could win admission to college if they caught an inmate trying to escape, an incentive system that ambitious guards seized upon. They would enable prisoners to make an escape attempt, Ahn said, and shoot them before they reached the fences that surround the camps. Most often, though, Ahn said, prisoners were beaten, sometimes to death, simply because guards were bored or in a sour mood. Although prison guards and their legitimate children belong by blood to the core class, They are fringe functionaries locked away for most of their working lives in the freezing hinterlands. The core of the core lives in Pyongyang, in large apartments or single-family homes in gated neighborhoods. Outsiders do not know with any certainty how many of these elite there are in North Korea, but South Korean and American scholars believe they are a tiny fraction of the country's population, numbering between 1 and 200,000 out of 23 million. Trusted and talented members of the elite are periodically allowed outside the country, where they serve as diplomats and traders for state-owned companies. In the past decade, the United States government and law enforcement agencies around the world have documented that some of these North Koreans are involved in criminal enterprises that funnel hard currency to Pyongyang. They have been linked to counterfeiting $100 bills, cyber terrorism, trafficking drugs ranging from heroin to Viagra, and marketing high-quality brand name but counterfeit cigarettes. In violation of United Nations resolutions, North Koreans have also sold rockets and nuclear weapons technology to countries including Iran and Syria, according to UN officials. One well-traveled member of the North Korean elite told me how he earned his keep while securing the support and affections of Kim Jong-il. His name is Kim Kwon-jin. He grew up in Pyongyang as a member of the Blue Blood elite. He studied British literature at Kim Il-sung University, which is reserved for children of top officials. His professional expertise, before defecting to South Korea in 2003, was managing a state-run global insurance fraud. It collected hundreds of millions of dollars from some of the world's largest insurance companies on falsified claims for industrial accidents and natural disasters inside North Korea, and it funneled most of the money to the dear leader. The festive annual highlight of this scheme took place in the week before Kim Jong-il's birthday on February 16th. Foreign-based executives of the Korean National Insurance Corporation, the state monopoly that orchestrated the fraud, prepared a special birthday gift. From his office in Singapore, Kim Kwon-jin watched in early February 2003 as his colleagues stuffed $20 million in cash into two heavy-duty bags and sent them, via Beijing, to Pyongyang. This was money that had been paid by international insurance companies, and it was not a one-time offering. Kim said that in the 5 years he was based in Pyongyang for the State Insurance Corporation, bags of cash always arrived in time for his leader's birthday. He said they came from Switzerland, France, and Austria, as well as from Singapore. The money, he said, was delivered to Office 39 of the Korean Workers' Party Central Committee. This infamous office, or bureau, was created by Kim Jong-il in the 1970s to collect hard currency and to give him a power base independent of his father, who was then still running the country. According to Kim and scores of other defectors in published accounts, Office 39 buys luxury goods to secure the loyalty of the North Korean elite. It also funds the purchase of foreign-made components for missiles and other weapons programs. As Kim explained it to me, his country's insurance scam worked like this. Pyongyang-based managers for the state insurance monopoly would write policies that covered costly but common North Korean disasters, such as mining accidents, train crashes, and crop losses resulting from floods. The major point of the reinsurance operation is that they are banking on disaster, he said. Whenever there is a disaster, it becomes a source of hard currency for the government. Kim and other foreign-based operatives of the North Korean insurance company were dispatched around the globe to find insurance brokers who would accept seductively high insurance premiums to compensate North Korea for the cost of these disasters. Reinsurance is a multi-billion dollar industry that spreads the risk assumed by one insurance company to a number of companies around the world. Each year, Kim said, North Korea would do its best to shuffle its offerings among the major reinsurance players. We pass it around, he told me. One year it might be Lloyd's of London, the next year it might be Swiss Re. By spreading relatively moderate losses among many big companies, North Korea concealed how bad a risk it was. Its government prepared meticulously documented claims, rushed them through its puppet court, and demanded immediate payment. But it often restricted the ability of reinsurers to dispatch investigators to verify claims. According to a London-based expert on the insurance industry, North Korea also exploited the geographical ignorance and political naivete of some reinsurers and their brokers. Many of them thought they were dealing with a firm from South Korea, the expert said, while others were unaware that North Korea is a closed, totalitarian state with sham courts and no international accountability. Over time, reinsurance companies got wise to frequent and costly claims for train crashes and ferry sinkings that were all but impossible to investigate. Lawyers for German insurance giant Allianz Global Investors, Lloyd's of London, and several other reinsurers filed suit in a London court against the Korean National Insurance Corporation. They contested its claim for a 2005 crash of a helicopter into a government-owned warehouse in Pyongyang. In court documents, the companies alleged that the crash was staged, that the North Korean court's decision to uphold the claim had been rigged, and that North Korea routinely used insurance fraud to raise money for the personal use of Kim Jong-il. The reinsurance companies, however, dropped their claims and agreed to a settlement that was a near-complete victory for North Korea. They did so, legal analysts said, because they had foolishly signed contracts in which they agreed to be bound by North Korean law. After the settlement, North Korea's lawyers said it was staggeringly unfair to suggest that the country engaged in insurance fraud. But publicity generated by the case alerted the world's reinsurance industry to avoid North Korea, and fraud wound down. When Kim Kwang-jin helped send the $20 million bags of cash from Singapore to Pyongyang, he said that Kim Jong-il was delighted. "We received a letter of thanks, and it was a great celebration," he said, noting that Kim Jong-il arranged for him and his colleagues to receive gifts that included oranges, apples, DVD players, and blankets. Fruit, home electronics, and blankets. This meager display of dictatorial gratitude is telling. In Pyongyang, living standards for the core class are luxurious only by the standards of a country where a third of the population is chronically hungry. Elites have relatively large apartments and access to rice. They are also granted first dibs on imported luxuries such as fruit and liquor. But for residents of Pyongyang, electricity is intermittent at best. Hot water is rarely available, and travel outside the country is difficult except for diplomats and state-sponsored businessmen. An elite family in Pyongyang does not live nearly as well in terms of material possessions, creature comforts, and entertainment options as the family of an average salaryman in Seoul, Andrei Lankov, a Russian-born political scientist who attended college in Pyongyang and now teaches at Kukmin University in Seoul, told me. Average per capita income in South Korea is 15 times as high as in the North, $1,900 in 2009. Countries with higher per capita incomes than North Korea include Sudan, Congo, and Laos. The exception, of course, is the Kim family dynasty. Satellite images of the family's residences stand out like sable-clad thumbs in the mangy landscape of North Korea. The family maintains at least 8 country houses, according to books by his former chef and a former bodyguard. Nearly all of them have movie theaters, basketball courts, and shooting ranges. Several have indoor swimming pools along with entertainment centers for bowling and roller skating. Satellite pictures show a full-size horse racing track, a private train station, and a water park. A private yacht, which has a 50-meter pool with 2 water slides, was photographed near the family's house in Wonsan, which is located on a peninsula with white sandy beaches and is believed to be a family favorite. The former bodyguard said Kim Jong-il often went there to hunt roe deer, pheasants, and wild geese. All his houses have been furnished with imports from Japan and Europe. The family's beef is raised by bodyguards on a special cattle ranch, and their apples come from an organic orchard where sugar, a rare and costly commodity in the north, is added to the soil to sweeten the fruit. The privileges of blood are uniquely rich in the Kim family. Kim Jong-il inherited his dictatorial control of North Korea from his father in 1994, the first hereditary succession in the communist world. The second such succession occurred in December 2011 after Kim's death at age 69. His youngest son, Kim Jong-un, was promptly hailed as the supreme leader of the party, state, and army. Although it was unclear if he, his older relatives, or the generals would wield real power, propagandists worked overtime, manufacturing a new cult of personality. Kim Jong-un was described in the party daily, Rodong Sinmun, as the spiritual pillar and lighthouse of hope for the military and the people. The state news agency noted that the new leader is a prominent thinker-theoretician and peerlessly illustrious commander who will be a solid foundation for the prosperity of the country. Other than having the right blood, the son's qualifications were meager. He attended a German-language school in Liebefeld, Switzerland, where he played point guard on the basketball team and spent hours making pencil drawings of Chicago Bulls great Michael Jordan. He returned to Pyongyang at 17 to attend Kim Il-sung University. Little is known about what he studied there. Preparations for a second father-to-son transfer of power became apparent in Pyongyang shortly after Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke in 2008. It left the dear leader with a noticeable limp and signaled the emergence of Kim Jong-un from obscurity. In lectures delivered to select audiences in Pyongyang in 2009, Kim Jong-un was described as a genius of the literary arts and a patriot who is working without sleep or rest to promote North Korea as a nuclear superpower. A propaganda song, Footsteps, was circulated at military bases to prepare the cadre for the coming of a dynamic young general. He was indeed young, in his late 20s, born in either 1983 or 1984. At his coming out party in September 2010, the young general's face was officially shown to the world for the first time. He was the spitting image of his late grandfather, Kim Il-sung, who was always more beloved than Kim Jong-il. That uncanny resemblance, as Kim Jong-un moved to consolidate power after the death of his father, seemed orchestrated. His clothes and haircut, Mao suits and a short military trim with no sideburns, were the same as his grandfather's when he seized control of North Korea in 1945. Rumors circulated in South Korea that the resemblance had been enhanced by plastic surgeons in Pyongyang to render the young man as a kind of great leader, too. If the new leader is to secure the same steely grip on the country as his father and grandfather, he certainly needs some measure of public support, along with solid backing from the military. His father, Kim Jong-il, might never have been popular, but he had nearly 20 years to learn how to dominate his elders. He had hand-picked many of the leading generals and was effectively running the country when his father died in 1994. Not yet 30 years old, with less than 3 years to learn the levers, Kim Jong-un has no such advantage. Until he figures it out, he will have to depend on his privileged blood, a budding cult of personality, and the loyalty of relatives, courtiers, and generals who may or may not be content to stand in the shadows. Chapter 4. Mother Tries to Escape. Shin was putting on his shoes in the school dormitory when his teacher came looking for him. It was Saturday morning, April 6, 1996. "Hey, Shin, come out as you are," the teacher said. Puzzled as to why he had been summoned, Shin hurried out of the dormitory and into the schoolyard. There, three uniformed men were waiting for him beside a jeep. They handcuffed him, blindfolded him with a strip of black cloth, and pushed him into the back seat of the jeep. Without saying a word, they drove him away. Shin had no idea where he was being taken or why, but after a half hour of bouncing along in the back seat, he became afraid and began to tremble. When the jeep stopped, the men lifted Shin out and stood him on his feet. He heard the clunk of a heavy metal door opening and closing, then the whine of machinery. Guards nudged him into an elevator, and he felt himself descending. He had entered an underground prison inside the camp. After stepping out of the elevator, he was led down a corridor and into a large, bare, windowless room where guards removed his blindfold. Opening his eyes, he saw a military officer with four stars pinned to his uniform. The officer sat behind a desk. Two other guards in khaki stood nearby. One of them ordered Shin to sit down in a straight back chair. "You're Shin In-gun?" the officer with four stars asked. "Yes, that is correct," Shin replied.
"Shin Kyung-sub is the name of your father?"
"Yes."
"Jang Hee-kyung is your mother's name?"
"Yes." "Shin Hee-kyun is the name of your brother?"
"Yes."
The officer stared at Shin for about 5 minutes. Shin could not figure out where the interrogation was headed. "Do you know why you're here?" the officer asked at last.
"I don't know."
"Shall I tell you then?" Shin nodded yes. "At dawn today, your mother and your brother were caught trying to escape. That's why you're here. Understand? Were you aware of this fact or not?"
I didn't know."
Shin was so shocked by the news that he found it difficult to speak. He wasn't sure if he was awake or dreaming. The officer became increasingly angry and incredulous. "How is it possible for you not to know that your mother and brother tried to run away?" he asked. "If you want to live, you should spit out the truth." "No, I really didn't know," Shin said. "And your father didn't mention anything?" "It's been a while since I was last home," Shin replied. "When I visited a month ago, I heard nothing." "What kind of grievance does your family have to risk an escape?" the officer asked. "I honestly don't know anything." This was the story that Shin told when he arrived in South Korea in the late summer of 2006. He told it consistently, he told it often, and he told it well. His debriefings in Seoul began with agents from the government's National Intelligence Service, NIS. Experienced interrogators, they conduct extensive interviews with every North Korean defector and have been trained to screen out the assassins that Kim Jong-il's government periodically dispatched to the South. After the NIS, Shin told his stories to counselors and psychiatrists at a government center for resettlement, then to human rights activists and fellow defectors, and then to the local and international news media. He wrote about it in his 2007 Korean language memoir, and he told it to me when we first met in December 2008. He elaborated on it 9 months later during a week of day-long interviews with me in Seoul. There was, of course, no way to confirm what he was saying. Shin was the only available source of information about his early life. His mother and brother were dead. His father was still in the camp, or perhaps dead too. The North Korean government could hardly set the record straight, since it denies that Camp 14 exists. Still, the story had been vetted and rang true to survivors of other labor camps, to scholars, to human rights advocates, and to the South Korean government. I believed it and put it in the story that appeared in the Washington Post. I wrote that since his mother had not told him about the escape plan, Shin was startled to hear of it. On a cloudless morning in Torrance, California, Shin revisited and revised the story. We had been working on the book on and off for about a year, and for the past week we had been sitting across from each other in my dimly lighted room in a Best Western hotel, slowly sifting through the events of his early life. A day before this session, Shin said he had something new and important to disclose. He insisted that we find a new translator. He also invited Hannah Song, his then boss and de facto guardian, to listen in. Song was the executive director of Liberty in North Korea, the human rights group that had helped bring him to the United States. A 29-year-old Korean-American, she helped Shin manage his money, visas, travel, medical care, and behavior. She jokingly described herself as Shin's mom. Shin took off his sandals, tucked his bare feet underneath him on the hotel sofa. I turned on a tape recorder. The sound of morning traffic filtered into the room from Torrance Boulevard. Shin fidgeted with the buttons on his mobile phone. "So what's up?" I asked. Shin said he had been lying about his mother's escape. He invented the lie just before arriving in South Korea. "There were a lot of things I needed to hide," he said. "I was terrified of a backlash, of people asking me, 'Are you even human?' It has been a burden to keep this inside," he said. "In the beginning, I didn't think much of my lie. It was my intent to lie. Now the people around me make me want to be honest. They make me want to be more moral. In that sense, I feel like I need to tell the truth. I now have friends who are honest. I have begun to understand what honesty is. I feel extreme guilt for everything. I was more faithful to guards than to my family. We were each other's spies. I know by telling the truth, people will look down on me. Outsiders have a wrong understanding of the camp. It is not just the soldiers who beat us. It is the prisoners themselves who are not kind to each other. There is no sense of community. I am one of those mean prisoners." Shin said he did not expect forgiveness for what he was about to disclose. He said he had not forgiven himself. He also seemed to be trying to do something more than expiate guilt. He wanted to explain, in a way that he acknowledged would damage his credibility as a witness, how the camp had warped his character. He said that if outsiders could understand what political prison camps have done and are doing to children born inside the fence, it would redeem his lie and his life. Chapter 5, Mother Tries to Escape, Version 2. This story begins a day earlier, on the afternoon of Friday, April 5th, 1996. As school wound down for the day, Shin's teacher surprised him. He told Shin that he did not have to spend the night in the dormitory. He could go home and eat supper with his mother. The teacher was rewarding Shin for good behavior. After 2 years in the dormitory,
he had begun to figure out a few things.
He was less often a laggard, less often beaten, more often a snitch. Shin did not particularly want to spend the night at his mother's place. Living apart had not improved their relationship. He still didn't trust her to take care of him. She still seemed tense in his presence. The teacher, however, told him to go home, so he went. As unexpected as it had been for him to be sent home, there was a bigger surprise when Shin got there.
His brother, Hee Gyun, had come home, too.
He worked at the camp cement factory, located several miles away in the far southeast of the camp.
Shin barely knew and rarely saw Hee Gyun, who had been out of the house for a decade and was now 21.
All that Shin knew about his brother was that he was not a hard worker. He had rarely been granted permission to leave the factory to see his parents. For him to be in his mother's house, Shin thought, he must have finally done something right. Shin's mother was not delighted when her youngest son showed up unexpectedly for supper. She did not say welcome or that she had missed him. "Oh, you're home," she said. Then she cooked, using her daily ration of 700 grams of cornmeal to make porridge in the one pot she owned. With bowls and spoons, she and her sons ate on the kitchen floor. After he had eaten, Shin went to sleep in the bedroom. Voices from the kitchen woke him up. He peeked through the bedroom door, curious about what his mother and brother were up to. His mother was cooking rice. For Shin, this was a slap in the face. He had been served a watery corn soup, the same tasteless gruel he had eaten every day of his life. Now his brother was getting rice. It is difficult to overstate the importance of rice in North Korean culture. It signifies wealth, evokes the closeness of family, and sanctifies a proper meal. Labor camp prisoners almost never eat rice, and its absence is a daily reminder of the normality they can never have. Outside the camp, too, chronic shortages have removed rice from the daily diets of many North Koreans, especially those in the hostile classes. Teenage defectors from the North, when they arrive in South Korea, have told government counselors of a recurring dream. They are sitting at a table with their families, eating warm rice. Among the elite in Pyongyang, one of the most coveted signifiers of status is an electric rice cooker. As Shin watched his mother cook, he guessed she must have stolen the rice, a few grains at a time, from the farm where she worked and secreted it away in her house. In the bedroom, Shin fumed. He also listened. His brother was doing most of the talking. Shin heard that Hee Gyun had not been given the day off. Without permission, he had walked away from the cement factory, where he had apparently done something wrong. Shin realized his brother was in trouble, and that he would probably be punished when guards caught up with him. His mother and brother were discussing what they should do. Escape. Shin was astonished to hear the word. His brother said it. He was planning to run. His mother was helping him. Her precious hoard of rice was food for flight. Shin did not hear his mother say that she intended to go along, but she was not trying to argue her eldest into staying, even though she knew that if he escaped or died trying, she and others in her family would be tortured and probably killed. Every prisoner knew the first rule of Camp 14, subsection 2. Any witness to an attempted escape who fails to report it will be shot immediately. His mother did not sound alarmed, but Shin was. His heart pounded. He was angry that she would put his life at risk for the sake of his older brother. He was afraid he would be implicated in the escape and shot. He was also jealous that his brother was getting rice. On the floor of his mother's bedroom, as the aggrieved 13-year-old struggled to contain his fear, Shin's camp-bred instincts took over. He had to tell a guard. He got up off the floor, went into the kitchen, and headed out the door. "Where are you going?" his mother asked. "To the toilet," he said. Shin ran back to his school. It was 1 in the morning. He entered the school dormitory. His teacher had gone home to the gated Bowiwon village. Whom could he tell? In the crowded dormitory room where his class slept, Shin found his friend, Hong Sung-jo, and woke him up. As much as Shin trusted anyone, he trusted this boy. Shin told him what his mother and brother were planning and asked for advice. Hong told him to tell the school's night guard. They went together. As they walked to the guard's office in the main school building, Shin thought of a way to profit from his information. The guard was awake and in uniform. He told both boys to come inside his office. "I need to say something to you," Shin told the guard, whom he did not know. "But before I do, I want to get something in return." The guard assured Shin that he would help. "I want a guarantee of more food," Shin said. Shin's second demand was that he be named grade leader at school, a position that would allow him to work less and not be beaten as often. The guard guaranteed Shin that his request would be granted. Accepting the guard's word, Shin explained what his brother and mother were planning and where they were. The guard telephoned his superiors. He told Shin and Hong to go back to the dormitory and get some sleep. He would take care of everything. On the morning after he betrayed his mother and brother, uniformed men did come to the schoolyard for Shin. Just as he wrote in his memoir, just as he told everyone in South Korea, he was handcuffed, blindfolded, pushed into the back seat of a jeep, and driven away in silence to an underground prison inside the camp. But Shin knew why he had been summoned, and the guards in charge of Camp 14, he expected, knew he had tipped them off. Chapter 6. This Son of a Bitch Won't Do. "Do you know why you're here?" Shin knew what he had done. He had followed camp rules and stopped an escape. But the officer did not know, or did not care, that Shin had been a dutiful informer. "At dawn today, your mother and your brother were caught trying to escape. That's why you're here, understand? Were you aware of this fact or not? How is it possible for you not to know that your mother and brother tried to run away? If you want to live, you should spit out the truth." Confused and increasingly frightened, Shin found it difficult to speak. He was an informant. He could not understand why he was being interrogated as an accomplice. Shin would eventually figure out that the night guard at the school had claimed all the credit for discovering the escape plan. In reporting to his superiors, he had not mentioned Shin's role. But on that morning in the underground prison, Shin understood nothing. He was a bewildered 13-year-old. The officer with 4 stars kept asking him about the whys, whens, and hows of his family's escape plan. Shin was unable to say anything coherent. Finally, the officer pushed some papers across his desk. "In that case, bastard, read this and affix your thumbprint at the bottom." The document was a family rap sheet. It listed the names, ages, and crimes of Shin's father and of his father's 11 brothers. The eldest brother, Shin Tae Sub, was listed first. Next to his name was a date, 1951, the second year of the Korean War. On the same line, Shin saw his uncle's crimes, disruption of public peace, acts of brutality, and defection to the South. The same offenses were listed beside the name of Shin's second oldest uncle. It took Shin many months to understand what he had been allowed to see. The papers explained why his father's family had been locked up in Camp 14. The unforgivable crime Shin's father had committed was being the brother of 2 young men who had fled South during a fratricidal war that razed much of the Korean Peninsula and divided hundreds of thousands of families. Shin's unforgivable crime was being his father's son. Shin's father had never explained any of this. His father later told Shin about the day in 1965 when the family was taken away by security forces.
"Before dawn, they forced their way into a house owned by Shin's grandfather in Mundok County in South Pyongan Province.
It's a fertile farming area, located about 35 miles north of Pyongyang. Pack your things," the armed men shouted. They did not explain why the family was being arrested or where they were going. At daybreak, a truck showed up for their belongings. The family traveled for an entire day, a distance of about 45 miles on mountain roads, before arriving at Camp 14. As ordered, Shin put his thumbprint on the document. Guards blindfolded him again, led him out of the interrogation room, and marched him down a corridor. When they pulled away the blindfold, Shin read the number 7 on a cell door. Guards pushed him inside and tossed him a prison uniform. "Hey, son of a bitch, change into this." The uniform fit a large adult. When Shin pulled it over his short, bony frame, he disappeared into what felt like a burlap sack. Shin's cell was a concrete square, barely large enough for him to lie down. It had a toilet in the corner and a sink with running water. The light bulb hanging from the ceiling was on when Shin entered the cell, and it could not be turned off. Without windows, Shin could not distinguish night from day. There were two thin blankets on the floor. He was given nothing to eat and could not sleep. He believes it was the next day when guards opened the door, blindfolded him, and led him to a second interrogation room, where two new officers were waiting. They ordered Shin to kneel and pressed him to explain why his family wanted to escape. What grudges did his mother harbor? What did he discuss with her? What were his brother's intentions? Shin said he did not have answers to their questions. "You haven't lived but a few years," one of the guards told Shin. "Just confess and go out and live. Would you like to die in here?" I really don't know anything," he replied. He was increasingly frightened, increasingly hungry, and still struggling to understand why the guards did not know he was the one who had tipped them off. The guards sent him back to his cell. On what seemed to be the morning of the third day, one of his interrogators and three other guards entered Shin's cell. They shackled his ankles, tied a rope to a hook in the ceiling, and hung him upside down. Then they left and locked the door, all without a word. His feet almost touched the ceiling. His head was suspended about 2 feet above the floor.
Reaching out with his hands, which the guards had left untied,
Shin could not quite touch the floor. He squirmed and swung around, trying to right himself, but could not. His neck cramped and his ankles hurt. Eventually, his legs went numb. His head, flushed with blood, ached more with each hour. Guards did not return until evening. They untied the boy and left, again without a word. Food arrived in his cell, but Shin found it almost impossible to eat. He could not move his fingers. His ankles, owing to the sharp steel edges of the shackles, were gouged and bleeding. On the fourth day, the interrogators wore civilian clothes, not uniforms. After being blindfolded and marched from his cell, Shin met them in a dimly lighted room with a high ceiling. It had the look of a machine shop. A chain dangled from a winch on the ceiling. Hooks on the walls held a hammer, axe, pliers, and clubs of various shapes and sizes. On a wide shop table, Shin saw a large pair of pincers, a tool used for gripping and carrying pieces of hot metal. "How is it, being in this room?" one of the interrogators asked. Shin did not know what to say. "I'll ask you just one more time," the chief interrogator said. "What were your father, mother, and brother planning to do after their escape?"
I really don't know," Shin replied.
"If you tell the truth right now, I'll save you. If not, I'll kill you. Understand?" Shin remembers paralyzing confusion. "I've been easy on you until now because you're a kid," the interrogator said. "Don't try my patience." Again, Shin failed to reply. "This son of a bitch won't do," the chief interrogator shouted. The chief's lieutenant surrounded Shin and pulled off his clothes. Shackles were locked around his ankles and tied to the chain that hung from the ceiling. The winch started up, pulling Shin off his feet. His head hit the floor with a thud. His hands were bound together with a rope that was threaded through a hook on the ceiling. When the trussing was done, his body formed a U, his face and feet toward the ceiling, his bare back toward the floor. The chief interrogator shouted more questions. Shin remembers giving no coherent answers. The chief told one of his men to fetch something. A tub full of burning charcoal was dragged beneath Shin. One of the interrogators used a bellows to stoke the coals. The winch lowered Shin toward the flames. "Keep going until he talks," the chief said. Shin, crazed with pain, smelling his burning flesh, twisted away from the heat. One of the guards grabbed a gaff hook from the wall and pierced the boy in the lower abdomen, holding him over the fire until he lost consciousness. He awoke in his cell. Guards had dressed him in his ill-fitting prison outfit, which he'd soiled with excrement and urine. He had no idea how long he had lain unconscious on the floor. His lower back was blistered and sticky with discharge. The flesh around his ankles had been scraped away. For 2 days, Shin managed to crawl around in his cell and to eat.
Guards brought him whole steamed ears of corn, along with corn porridge and cabbage soup. But as his burns became infected, he grew feverish, lost his appetite, and found it nearly impossible to move. Seeing Shin curled up on the floor of his cell, a guard shouted in the prison hallway, "That little runt is really tough." Shin guesses 10 days came and went before his final interrogation. It took place in his cell because he was too weak to get up off the floor. But he was no longer afraid. For the first time, he found words to defend himself. "I was the one who reported this," he said. "I did a good job." His interrogators didn't believe him. But instead of threatening or hurting Shin, they asked questions. He explained all that he had heard in his mother's house and what he had said to the night guard at school. He begged his interrogators to talk to Hong Sung-jo, the classmate who could confirm the story. They promised nothing and left his cell. Shin's fever grew worse. Blisters on his back swelled with pus. His cell smelled so bad that guards refused to step inside. After several days, though the exact amount of time is unclear, as Shin was drifting in and out of delirium, guards opened his cell door and ordered two prisoners to go in. They picked him up and carried him down the corridor to another cell. Guards locked Shin inside. There was another prisoner in the cell. Shin had been granted a reprieve. Hong had confirmed his story. Shin would never see the school's night guard again. Chapter 7. The Sun Shines Even on Mouse Holes. By the standards of Camp 14, Shin's cellmate was notably old, somewhere around 50. He refused to explain why he was locked up in the camp's underground prison. But he did say he had been there for many years and that he sorely missed the sun. Pallid, leathery skin sagged over his fleshless bones. His name was Kim Jin-myung. He asked to be called Uncle. Shin was in no condition to say much of anything for several weeks. Fever kept him curled up on the cold floor, where he expected to die. He could not eat and told his cellmate to take his food. Uncle ate some of it, but only until the boy's appetite returned. In the meantime, Uncle went to work as Shin's full-time nurse. He turned mealtimes into thrice-daily medical treatments, using a wooden spoon as a squeegee on Shin's infected blisters. "There's a lot of pus here," he told Shin. "I'm going to scrape it away, so bear with me." He rubbed salty cabbage soup into the wounds as a disinfectant. He massaged Shin's arms and legs so that his muscles would not atrophy. To prevent urine and feces from coming into contact with the boy's wounds, he carried the cell's chamber pot to Shin and hoisted him up so he could use it. Shin guesses that this intensive care went on for about 2 months. He had a sense that Uncle had done this kind of work before, judging from his competence and calm. On occasion, Shin and Uncle could hear the screams and moans of a prisoner being tortured. The room with the winch and the clubs seemed to be just down the corridor. Prison rules banned inmates from talking, but in their cell, which was just large enough for Shin and Uncle to lie side by side, they could whisper. Shin discovered later that guards knew about these conversations. Uncle seemed to Shin to have special standing with the guards. They cut his hair and lent him scissors so he could trim his beard. They brought him cups of water. They told him the time of day when he asked. They gave him extra food, much of which he shared with Shin. "Kid, you have a lot of days to live," Uncle said. "They say the sun shines even on mouse holes." The old man's medical skills and his caring words kept the boy alive. His fever waned, his mind cleared, and his burns congealed into scars. It was Shin's first exposure to sustained kindness, and he was grateful beyond words. But he also found it puzzling. He had not trusted his mother to keep him from starving. At school, he trusted no one, with the possible exception of Hong Sung-jo, and informed on everyone. In return, he expected abuse and betrayal. In the cell, Uncle slowly reconfigured these expectations. The old man said he was lonely and seemed genuinely happy to share his space and his meals with someone else. He never once angered or frightened Shin or undermined his recovery. The routines of prison life following Shin's interrogation and torture, discounting the screaming that periodically echoed down the prison corridor, were oddly sustaining. Although the food was tasteless, Guards delivered enough of it for Shin and Uncle to survive. There was no dangerous outside labor, no exhausting work quotas. For the first time in his life, Shin wasn't expected to do any physical labor. Other than nursing the boy, Uncle was a man of leisure. He exercised daily in his cell. He cut Shin's hair. He was an entertaining talker whose knowledge of North Korea thrilled Shin, especially when the subject was food. "Uncle, tell me a story," Shin would say. The old man described what food outside the fence looked, smelled, and tasted like. Thanks to his loving descriptions of roasting pork, boiling chicken, and eating clams at the seashore, Shin's appetite came back with a vengeance. As his health improved, guards began to call him out of the cell. They were now very much aware that Shin had snitched on his own family. They pressed him to inform on the old man. "You two are in there together," a guard said to Shin. "What does he say? Don't conceal anything." Back in the cell, Uncle wanted to know, "What did they ask you?" Squeezed between his nurse and his jailers, Shin elected to tell the truth to both sides. He told Uncle that the guards had asked him to be an informer. This did not surprise the old man. He continued to entertain Shin with long stories about good things to eat, but he did not volunteer biographical information. He would not talk about his family. He expressed no opinions about the government. Shin guessed, based on the way Uncle used language, that he had once been an important and well-educated man, but it was only a guess. Although it was a crime to talk about escaping from Camp 14, it was not against the rules to fantasize about what life would be like if the government were to set you free. Uncle told Shin that both of them would one day be released. Until then, he said, they had a sacred obligation to stay strong, live as long as possible, and never consider suicide. "What do you think?" Uncle would then ask Shin. "Do you believe I'll also be able to make it out?" Shin doubted it, but said nothing. A guard unlocked the door of Shin's cell and handed him the school uniform he had worn on the day he arrived in the underground prison. "Put on these clothes and come along quickly," the guard said. As Shin changed, he asked Uncle what would happen. The old man assured him that he would be safe and that they would meet again on the outside. "Let me hold you once," he said, grasping both of Shin's hands tightly. Shin did not want to leave the cell. He had never trusted, never loved anyone before. In the years ahead, he would think of the old man in the dark room far more often and with far greater affection than he thought of his parents. But after guards let him out of the cell and locked its door, he never saw Uncle again. Chapter 8. Avoiding Mother's Eyes. They took Shin to the big bare room where, in early April, he had first been interrogated. Now it was late November. Shin had just turned 14. He had not seen the sun for more than half a year. What he did see in the room startled him. His father knelt in front of two interrogators who sat at their desks. He seemed much older and more careworn than before. He had been brought into the underground prison at about the same time as Shin. Kneeling beside him, Shin saw that his father's right leg canted outward in an unnatural way. Shin Gyeong-sub had also been tortured. Below his knee, his leg bones had been broken, and they had knitted back together at an odd angle. The injury would end his relatively comfortable job as a camp mechanic and lathe operator. He would now have to hobble around as an unskilled laborer on a construction crew. During his time in the underground prison, guards told Shin's father that his youngest son had informed them of the escape plan. When Shin later had a chance to talk to his father about this, the conversation was strained. His father said it was better to have told the guards than to have risked concealing the plan. But his caustic tone confused Shin. He sounded as if he knew his son's first instinct was to inform. "Read it and stamp it," one of the interrogators said, handing a document to Shin and one to his father. It was a non-disclosure form, stipulating that father and son would not tell anyone what had gone on inside the prison. If they did talk, the document said, they would be punished. After pressing their ink thumbs to their respective forms, they were handcuffed, blindfolded, and led outside to the elevator. Above ground, their cuffs and blindfolds still on, they were guided into the back seat of a small car and driven away. In the car, Shin guessed that he and his father would be released back into the camp's population. Guards would not force them to sign a secrecy pledge and then shoot them. It did not make sense. But when the car stopped after about 30 minutes and his blindfold was removed, he panicked. A crowd had gathered at the empty wheat field near his mother's house. This was the place where Shin had witnessed 2 or 3 executions a year since he was a toddler. A makeshift gallows had been constructed, and a wooden pole had been driven into the ground. Shin was now certain that he and his father were to be executed. He became acutely aware of the air passing into and out of his lungs. He told himself these were the last breaths of his life. His panic subsided when a guard barked out his father's name. "Hey, Gyung Sub, go sit at the very front." Shin was told to go with his father. A guard removed their handcuffs. They sat down. The officer overseeing the execution began to speak. Shin's mother and brother were dragged out. Shin had not seen them or heard anything about their fate since he walked out of his mother's house on the night he betrayed them.
"Execute Jang Hee-gyung
and Shin Hee-gyun, traitors of the people," the senior officer said. Shin looked at his father. He was weeping silently. The shame Shin feels about the executions has been compounded over the years by the lies he began telling in South Korea. "There is nothing in my life to compare with this burden," Shin told me on the day in California when he explained how and why he had misrepresented his past. But he was not ashamed on the day of the executions. He was angry. He hated his mother and brother with the savage clarity of a wronged and wounded adolescent. As he saw it, he had been tortured and nearly died, and his father had been crippled because of their foolish, self-centered scheming. And only minutes before he saw them on the execution grounds, Shin had believed he would be shot because of their recklessness. When guards dragged her to the gallows, Shin saw that his mother looked bloated. They forced her to stand on a wooden box, gagged her, tied her arms behind her back, and tightened a noose around her neck. They did not cover her swollen eyes. She scanned the crowd and found Shin. He refused to hold her gaze. When guards pulled away the box, she jerked about desperately. As he watched his mother struggle, Shin thought she deserved to die. Shin's brother looked gaunt and frail as guards tied him to the wooden post. 3 guards fired their rifles 3 times. Bullets snapped the rope that held his forehead to the pole. It was a bloody, brain-splattered mess of a killing, a spectacle that sickened and frightened Shin. But he thought his brother, too, had deserved it. Chapter 9. Reactionary Son of a Bitch. Executions of parents for attempted escape were not uncommon in Camp 14. Shin witnessed several before and after his mother's hanging. It wasn't clear, though, what happened to the children they left behind in the camp. As far as Shin could determine, none of these children were allowed to go to school, except for him. Perhaps because he was a proven snitch, camp authorities sent him back to school, but his return wasn't easy. Trouble started as soon as Shin walked from the execution grounds to his school, where he had a private meeting with his teacher. Shin had known this man for 2 years, although he never learned his name, and regarded him as relatively fair-minded, at least by camp standards. At the meeting, though, the teacher was seething. He wanted to know why Shin had tipped off the school's night guard about the escape plot. "Why didn't you come to me first?" he shouted. "I wanted to, but I couldn't find you," Shin replied, explaining that it was late at night and the teacher's compound was off-limits to prisoners. "You could have waited until the morning," the teacher said. The teacher had not received any credit from his superiors for uncovering the escape plot. He blamed this miscarriage of justice on Shin and warned the boy that he would pay for his thoughtlessness. When Shin's class, about 35 students, assembled later in the classroom, the teacher pointed at Shin and shouted, "Come up front. Kneel." Shin knelt on the concrete floor for nearly 6 hours. When he wiggled to ease his discomfort, the teacher whacked him with a blackboard pointer. On his second day back at school, Shin walked with his class to a camp farm to gather corn straw and haul it to a threshing floor. Shin pulled an A-frame carrier loaded with straw. It was relatively light work compared to pushing coal carts, but it required that he wear a kind of harness with a leather strap that chafed the tender scars on his lower back and tailbone. Soon, blood was oozing down his legs. The pants of his school uniform were soaked. Shin dared not complain. His teacher had warned him that he would need to work harder than his classmates to wash away the sins of his mother and brother. At school and during field work, all students had to ask permission to urinate.